Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. It can be hard to get your head around the threat of a wildfire, especially if you live in the city. We hear news reports, as we did last March, of more than 1 million acres scorched across the plains and the Texas Panhandle, and we struggle to comprehend the scale, let alone the danger. But ranchers and their rural Texas neighbors know only too well how hot, dry winds can turn a spark into an inferno on the prairie, how quickly those winds can change direction, and how fires claim victims even among those doing all the right things to fight them. Skip Hollinsworth is executive editor at Texas Monthly. He wrote the magazine's cover story this month, an account of the March 6th weather event linked to massive fires in Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas. As he'll tell us, he discovered not just tragedy, but a hero's tale and a love story. You can find a link to the piece at think.kera.org. Skip, welcome back to Think.
Thank you.
The National Weather Service saw this coming, but there's nothing anybody could have done to keep it from happening. What was the combination of conditions that caused the National Weather Service to call up the Forestry Service and firefighters across the state?
So this meteorologist in Norman, Oklahoma, named Todd Lindley, was looking at his computer screens and projecting storms coming over the Pacific, and he saw a pinwheel of clouds over the northern Pacific, and he began to do computer projections, and he realized they would come over the Rockies and hit the Great Plains on March 6th, right around noon. And that's what meteorologists can do these days. And you would think, well, they do this every single day, so big deal. But early this spring, the grasses in the Panhandle and in the southern Great Plains, the western Panhandle of Oklahoma, the Panhandle of Texas, and western Kansas, were high. They were dry as hay. There had been excessive rains earlier that year, so there was tons of grass that was yellowed and stalk-like and ready to burn because there had been so many years of drought that there weren't enough cattle out there to eat up all the grassland. So there were these stands of grasses and shrubs that were going across the Panhandle that were just ready to be burned. And when this meteorologist saw the winds coming in and saw the storm coming in with winds, he immediately said to himself, fire. Because all it takes is like a chain scraping against a highway road, concrete, that sets off a spark. And usually those sparks just turn into little benign fires that burn a little bit and then go away. But with the wind, those fires can take off and start galloping like horses across the plains, like something out of the 19th century.
It made me think about, you know, when you get a hurricane warning, if you live in a hurricane place, but, you know, when you receive it, the sky is clear and beautiful. There's no evidence. It's like our senses don't tell us what's about to happen.
Correct. And the cowboys don't stop working. You know, just because there's a fire danger or a wind danger, they get those all the time. The Panhandle, that part of the world, is known for its wind. But the combination of wind, there was low humidity, there were high temperatures, and there was made the chances of a fire very significant. But the cowboys kept going, tending to their cattle.
Because that's what you do.
It's exactly what you do. This is the cowboy way, is the phrase they use out there, and it's true.
What kinds of preparations did fire departments do, knowing that this might happen?
Well, the fire departments are volunteer fire departments. You know, those of us who don't go to the Panhandle very often, and I was one of them prior to this story, forget that these little towns survive on volunteer fire departments that have some modified pickup trucks with water tanks on them that are called grass rigs that can drive out through the pastures and shoot these prairie fires down. But they're small departments, and there's a very limited number of trucks. And when a big wildfire gets going, there's nothing they can do.
There's only so much water you can carry. They're miles away in most cases from any source of running water.
Yeah, and then they shoot a little stream of water along the edge of the fire, and then they've got to go to a tanker and refill and come back. And it's a hopeless battle.
We were talking about the fact that this is the classic human versus nature conflict. There are no villains here. Everybody is really decent and beloved. Tell us about Cody Crockett.
Well, I learned this story by reading the newspapers. I was just a typical city Texan. You know, I know very little about ranching, and I know very little about cattle raising, and I don't make any bones about that. But I saw this photo of Cody Crockett, this young cowboy, who in this one line in a story in the Amarillo newspaper had ridden out to save his cattle from the oncoming fires. And I saw a picture of his girlfriend, Sydney Wallace, and I saw a picture of a third young man, Sloan Everett, who also had some cattle on that same ranch, and read about this attempt that they made to save their cattle despite the onslaught of a wildfire coming at them. And I thought, who lives like that? Who thinks that way? And I began to write letters to the families, sending them emails to say, can I talk about what happened on that day that the wildfires came slamming into your lives, leaving a kind of tragic ending that no one could have imagined? And they began to talk, and I got to know especially Cody's parents and his mother, Christy, and a lot of people in this little town, panhandle town called McLean, who began to talk about Cody. And Cody was a boy who grew up drinking Dr. Pepper's on his floor in his living room, talking to his buddies about how he was going to work on the big ranches someday, the 4-6s. And he was on a horse at 2. He was going to spring brandings by the age of 9. He was known around town, around that part of the panhandle, for his ability to throw a good loop, which is a flat rope to catch calves. He had this sort of innate Michael Jordan ability to be a good cowboy, and all the veteran cowboys would watch him, even as a boy, do things like roping, herding, sorting, patching fence, and they would say, he's going to make a good hand, which is the ultimate compliment in those cowboy communities. A good hand is someone who can work a ranch. And already some of the veteran cowmen were saying, one day we're going to hire him, and he's going to be one of my best cowboys. And for me, I have to admit that, you know, being a city Texan, I didn't know that boys still wanted to grow up to become cowboys, that they learned from their fathers and their grandfathers, and it never occurred to them to do anything else. And that was Cody. In high school, he would sit in the back of his classroom and get on the phone and order hay for a ranch where he was working. He wore the same outfit, cowboy clothes, to school every single day. And as soon as school was, he played on the six-man football team, but as soon as school or practice was over, off he would go to work on ranches, to learn to break horses, to ride colts. It was just a life that we think is something out of fiction, but it really was happening right there.
As I was taking notes reading the story, I wrote the word prodigy because he was like a child prodigy, no less than a kid who would grow up to, you know, play concert piano.
And he would like sit with the old cowboys when they would gather and drink beers at the end of the day. And he would sit with them to listen to them talk about things like which ropes they use and which kind of pickup trucks they like the best. And, you know, going into that world and talking to these people, it's a world to itself. I mean, they use a language that we don't use. They think of things in a way that we don't think of. They, you know, for instance, they never say lasso. They never say corral. They say ropes and pins. They don't say, when they talk to me, it's never, they would always say yes, sir, and no, sir. But they would never say, sir, like a military. Yes, sir. It's always on the first syllable. Yes, sir. No, sir. And they would say that lunch was not lunch. It was supper. It was dinner. And the third meal of the day was supper. And it's all this kind of world that, to me, was like going into the Amazon and seeing this kind of the way this community works, the community that puts beef on our plates.
How many Texases are there? You know, if you think about urban Texas and rural Texas, maybe the border is its own entity.
Well, I'm not sure this is an answer to your question, but I was driving down here. I was thinking about Texas is 167 million acres in size, 261,000 square miles. Of that 160 million acres, 130 million acres are farms and ranches. So we, you know, think we live in these urban enclaves, but we're not part of the real Texas that still is out there. We have 11.8 million cattle that are on the range somewhere in a Texas farm or ranch, which is far ahead of any other state. Nebraska is second with like 6 million. And this is a state for all of our urban growth and suburban growth. We talk about Frisco and the quarter between Austin and San Antonio growing and the Woodlands in Houston, where it's still a rural ranching state.
And as you mentioned, you know, these are people who contribute to the lives of the rest of us. I had cream in my coffee this morning. You might have a steak for dinner. It's easy to get disconnected from that.
And it's because we think it's just this world that's inaccessible, that modernization has gotten rid of the old cowboy, that there's no need for cowboys like there used to be. But that's not true. You have to have a cowboy get on a horse and go into the pastures and look at the cattle that are grazing. And it's the cowboy's job to make sure those cows grow from like 300 or 400 pounds to 700 or 800 pounds before they go to the feedlot and then to the slaughterhouse. And they've got to watch those cattle to make sure that they are growing, that they are not sick. And it's an old, ancient tradition of being out there with your horse and your rope. And, of course, you're wearing your cowboy hat, not because it's fashionable, but because it keeps the sun off your face.
You mentioned Sloan Everett a moment ago, a third person who was trapped by these fires. He and his wife met working these quintessential Dallas jobs, right? He's working for Hunt Oil. She works for Neiman Marcus. But they both had ranch roots.
Yeah, I mean, in the cities, you come across people who all the time who grew up on ranches and moved to the city and go to the ranches on weekends. And that's what Sloan and Liesel seemed like they were headed to do. I mean, Liesel was this beauty who grew up in Amarillo, her mother was one of the heirs to the Franklin Ranch, where this story occurs, this famous East Panhandle Ranch. She goes to Baylor. She majors in fashion merchandising. She comes to Dallas to work online at Neiman Marcus. Sloan comes from a family in Breckenridge, which is a little bit southeast of the Panhandle. But they have a huge ranch. He goes to Baylor. He majors in entrepreneurship. He then goes to work for Hunt Oil. He's on his way in the oil business. He's working for Hunt Oil in Dallas. But when he takes Liesel on some of their first dates back to his apartment at, of all places, the Village Apartments in North Dallas, he plays her cowboy songs on his guitar. He reads to her from an old cowboy book, and he says, you know, no matter what career I have here, what I really want to do is go back and help my dad run the ranches. And Liesel said, what I really want to do is go live on a ranch. And so the marriage was inevitable. And when they got married, she walked down the aisle at the Franklin Ranch to the theme song from Lonesome Dove. And I just thought, it's a dream.
My guest is Skip Hollandsworth. He's executive editor at Texas Monthly and author of its cover story this month, Love and Loss on the Plains, the Day the Fire Came to the Franklin Ranch. Actually, that's the August issue. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter. We are @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Texas Monthly executive editor Skip Hollinsworth. His article, Love and Loss on the Plains, The Day the Fire Came to the Franklin Ranch, is the cover story for the August issue of Texas Monthly. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So by March of this year, Skip, when the fire happened, Sloan and Liesl had two little kids. She was expecting her third. So he decides to go check on some heifers and calves that he has at Franklin Ranch that are under the care of Cody Crockett. And they decided they would just combine the trip. She would see her mom and he would go check on the cat.
And they did this all the time because the Franklin Ranch is one of these beautiful ranches where if you see it, you think, well, I want a ranch. I mean, you can understand why people who have no ranching experience spend all their money on buying a ranch and end up, you know, having cowboys run it for them because they have no idea what they're doing. But Sloan kept some cattle on the ranch there because the drought in the Breckenridge Ranch, where he originally lived, was so strong that there was a need to move him up there. And the kids would play, and Sloan would check on the cattle. And on March 6th, that's exactly what they planned to do. They knew that the winds were going to be up, and they knew there were fire warnings out. But it's the panhandle. It's this huge swath of land with pastures as vast as the ocean. And what are the chances that one of these fires are going to hit our ranch or hit outside our ranch and come our way? I mean, it just, the chances were almost infinitesimally zero.
So Sloan was on an all-terrain vehicle. Cody was on a horse.
So there was a fire that two electric lines sparked and set off a fire about 6 to 10 miles away from the Franklin Ranch, and here it came. And when the winds are behind it, the fires can go 6 to 7 miles an hour, which doesn't sound fast, but it's fast. And it starts spreading as it goes. And it began to move like this, you know, this onslaught just coming at you, monstrous, building higher with flames beginning to go 20 feet high and clouds of billowing black, throat-clogging smoke in front of the flames. And initially, it just looked like there was some smoke in the distance. And so Sloan said, I'm going to go out and told his family, I'm going to go out and check on my cattle in the west pasture. And there were no horses nearby from the main ranch headquarters. So he just jumped into a four-wheeler and drove over there. Well, at the same time, Cody and his girlfriend, Sydney, were at another part of the ranch. And they saw the smoke. And Cody said, I need to go check and see if it's headed our way. And Sydney said, I'm coming with you, because she loved the cowboy life and loved to be with Cody. So here is Sloan headed toward this pasture, and Sydney and Cody headed toward it in a separate direction. And they got there, and the flame still looked sort of far away, and they made a decision to move the cows south to a neighboring ranch. There's a gate between the two ranches, away from where it looked like the fire was moving. Sloan at one point called Liesl, his wife, to check on her to make sure she was leaving the house. And, you know, Liesl would later play the message back and could hear Sloan making that yip, 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 yip sound, which helps herd the cattle toward the gate. And Cody was such an excellent cowboy and so good at it, he got all the cattle off of that west pasture and through the gate, going south into another ranch called the Gething. And it was this sort of magnificent, athletic, industrial feat. They had saved the cattle. And Sydney, the girlfriend, who was actually a nurse at a hospital in Amarillo, was, we guess, opening the gates, and the cattle would come barging through. And there were young calves that had just been born. And, you know, a calf can start running after about a week. And they were trotting along. And Cody and Sloan were behind the herd, sort of pushing them forward. And it was, this little minor cattle drive that got the cows to safety.
And then the wind moved.
And so the wind was coming east and blowing this fire east. And they thought they were below the line of fire. And this is the cruel, fascinating part of nature is that the wind slightly shifted for reasons that the great meteorologists who were able to predict when the winds were going to come could not predict. The winds began to move southeast. And for people standing in their yards, they might have felt a little bit of a breeze, but nothing significant. But Cody, who knew these lands well, had to have realized exactly what was happening. The fire was suddenly coming toward them. And as far away as it seemed, it started moving.
So what did they do?
Well, some of the panhandle ranches, for outsiders like us, we used to think of panhandle ranches as just simply flat ground, but they're actually hills and sand hills is what they're called, that look like sand dunes on a beach, except they're full of shrubs and grass.
Flammable material.
But Cody began to think the best thing for them to—and I'm speculating, of course— but based upon talking to all the other cowboys who were later out there and who knew the terrain as well and knew Cody, he probably thought the best way to beat the fire is to get up to the top of the hill, and maybe the fire will go around the hill in the draw, the lower part of the valley like part of the hill. And if we get to the top of the hill, we have a chance to survive. So the guess is that those who were out there guess that Sydney jumped on Cody's horse, on the back of Cody's horse, on the back behind Cody. Sloan was on his RV, and up this hill they came, and behind them came the fire. And it's this kind of dramatic, inevitable doom where the horse, trying to get up through the sand, fell and tumbled over and knocked Cody and Sydney off their horse. And Sloan apparently, as the smoke began to get closer, hit a barbed wire fence and threw himself off. Got thrown off the RV, four wheeler, and they had no choice but to run. And they started running in different directions because they can't see in that smoke. The smoke billows out in front of the fire. And I'm sure they yelled at one another. I'm sure Cody yelled at Sydney, his girlfriend, who he deeply loved. And I'm sure Sydney yelled back. And Sydney seemed to be able to get further away. She used to run cross country in high school. And yet here came the fires, closer and closer. And then the fire was on them.
All right, I want to go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org. Let's speak with Olivia in Dallas. Hi, Olivia.
Hi, Chris, and hi, Skip. I just want to tell you, I'm Olivia Franklin. I'm a granddaughter of O.M., and Frank, in fact, I was named for him. I work in Dallas as a courier and a process server because I spent too much time at the ranch on horseback, and I can't be in a building for very long. Hmm. But you did a beautiful job on a very involved story, and the way you're covering the people up there. I've always loved it up there. Didn't get to figure out a way to have that life for myself. However, my daughter is up northwest of there in Dalhart in charge of 80,000 head of cattle because she went to her great-grandfather, O.M. Franklin's alma mater, Kansas State, where he developed his serum for blackleg, which you wrote about. And she is cattle manager for Dalhart cattle feeders. So just like you said, you know, there are all these people around, and she grew up in Highland Park Schools, you know. But I put her on the horse when she was 6 months old. I had one of those baby carriers that I had on front of me, and I got on the horse and we rode, and I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. So
what's interesting is it really has
deep tentacles, you know.
What's interesting for me was the devotion to the ranching world that the men and women that live out there had. And you know, Joe McGee, who was the man that ran the cattle on the Franklin Ranch, the family had a leasing arrangement. He's a longtime panhandle cattleman, older man, Parkinson's disease, can't ride a horse anymore. Sometimes his hand shakes, but he gets up every morning and works cattle because he says, I can't think about doing anything else. I'm not qualified to do anything else. And he's a big cattleman. but that's all he cares about.
Cody's family understood that he was in trouble. Surely Sloan's family understood that he was in trouble. How were parties sent out to search for these people?
This is one of the most, at some point, there were cowboys and volunteer firefighters that were up on a bluff, and they noticed how the wind had changed, and they had looked at different pastures in the Franklin Ranch for Cody, Sidney, and Sloan. And they were trying to figure out where they could have gone because they were driving through the pastures, couldn't see them. And then finally it occurred to them, Cody had taken the cattle south. And so they started driving up along the fence line, and they saw Cody's horse with the saddle still smoldering from fire. So the horse had been able to get up and outrun the fire, or at least part of the fire, but was in such pain from the burns that he couldn't lift his head. And then they began, the night fell, and then the cowboys sort of gathered in a line and did what was called a brush call. They walked up the hills of this pasture, and they would make this sound, woo, 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 to keep themselves straight in line.
So you know somebody to your left or to your right is not too far ahead.
They would call each other woo woo, and then because they weren't expecting anything to happen, none of them had flashlights, and they used the flashlights on their cell phones. And imagine, here is this ancient tradition of a brush call combined with holding the cell phones, and it sort of sends chills up of your spine as they head up the hills. And at one point, one of the cowboys, including Cody's dad, yells, woo woo. And then they hear this quiet, hey, and it's Cody, and he's alive, and Sloan's alive. Brush fires, wildfires are different than forest fires. They're not as intense with the heat, and they move fast, and they sweep over you. And there's a chance you can live. And for a little bit, at least, the cowboys and Brock and everyone else, and the volunteer firefighters, and eventually Cody's mom and his two brothers, all got to the top of that hill thinking that maybe Cody and Sloan were going to live. Sidney was gone. She was curled up like a cat. And, these people will, it's something that no one ever expected happened, and these people will never be able to think about anything else, really. I won't.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Texas Monthly executive editor Skip Hollandsworth. We're talking about his cover story for the August issue, Love and Loss on the Plains, the day the fire came to the Franklin Ranch. They found Sloan and Cody alive in really bad shape. Cody managed to thank the paramedics for coming to pick him up.
The helicopters flew in. The cowboys took their pickups and made a circle so that there'd be a place for them to turn on their bright lights so the helicopters from the hospital would have a place to land. And Sloan went out first, and the paramedic came up to Sloan and saw how Sloan looked. Everything was burned. All the clothes were burned off his body, as was Cody. And he was barely able to speak, and the paramedic was so shocked that he began to recite the 23rd Psalm. And Sloan begin to recite it with him in his last moments alive. And then that helicopter took off, and another helicopter landed to get Cody. And here's a boy who, young man, 20 years old, who, was wearing his father had taken off his shirt and put it around Cody because he was shivering so much. He was getting delirious. He was saying things like, I've come a long way, Dad. And he saw the paramedics put him on a backboard and head him toward the helicopter. And Cody said, thank you all for coming. Now, who does that other than a cowboy? Who does that?
But he didn't make it.
He didn't make it.
All right, I want to go to the phones now. Our number, 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak next with Hank in Dallas. Hi, Hank.
Hi. How y'all doing?
Very well, thanks.
Skip, you're about to bring me to tears.
I'm in tears. I'm trying to hold it together.
What? Yeah. I was just going to say on your comment earlier about, I guess, city folk not wanting to let out of town. It's interesting. My dad grew up in Fort Worth in the 40s and 50s, and he had horses when he went to OSU. My brother wanted to be a cowboy, and he got a small ranch outside of Comanche. My grandfather on my mom's side bought a ranch in Kerrville when he retired from the oil company back in the late 60s, and I regret not going into it myself. So I just wanted to throw that on my both sides of my family. Everybody wanted to have cattle and some kind of ranch. I did grow up in San Angelo for a while, and I worked on a working sheep and cattle ranch during the summers. Of course, we didn't use horses. We were in Jeeps and stuff, but I'm going to definitely go out and buy your issue and read that story.
Yeah, well, thank you.
We have a tweet here that asks if you would talk about the health and future of Texas ranches, especially the smaller ones that can't necessarily absorb, you know, periods of drought, that sort of thing.
Well, I would like to say, you know, the conventional wisdom is that the ranch life is disappearing, and it's just not true. I mean, it's easier to make money with a big ranch. The marketing is better. The market is better. The value is better. You've got more head of cattle.
It's economies of scale.
Economies of scale. That's the phrase that I don't use. Thank you, Chris. But people, it's like this last caller. No matter what your life is like, you still want to give it a shot. And there's always people that are going to give the ranch and farm life a shot. They're going to go back and they're going to try it. And they're going to raise a few head of cattle. And they're going to sell them at the market. And they hope to make some money so they can do it again the next year. And if they don't, they'll sell out to somebody who's going to try it themselves.
My guest is Skip Hollinsworth. He's executive editor at Texas Monthly. He wrote the cover story for the August issue. It's called Love and Loss on the Plains, The Day the Fire Came to the Franklin Ranch. You can find a link to that piece at think.kera.org. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Skip Hollinsworth of Texas Monthly. He wrote the cover story for the August issue. It's called Love and Loss on the Plains, The Day the Fire Came to the Franklin Ranch. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Let's go now to Max in Pearland. Hi, Max.
Hello. I have a comment and a question for Chris. I was born in Sealy, Texas, about 50 miles west of Houston. I'm one of the last of the sharecroppers in Texas, born on a farm. We were sharecropping on Watson Flat between Sealy and Belleville. And it was too wet to grow cotton. Cotton wouldn't grow. It got too wet. So we grew beans so we'd have something to eat. Then we moved to town, Sealy, in 41 when I was 3 years old, and on a place Dad was able to buy for, I think Grandpa helped him, for $1,800, 10 acres, about an acre wide, 10 deep, along Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe Railroad track. And neighbors across the street had, I'd estimate, between 40 and 60-acre pasture they ran cattle on, and they burned it at night every fall. Three boys were born first, three girls were born next in that family. I was number 8 of 10 that were born, and number 7 of 8 who survived childbirth. And they were burning their pasture one fall, and somebody called the Sealy Fire Department to come out to put out a big fire. And I'll never forget James Mallaire leaning on his shovel when the firemen got there saying, "Don't y'all dare put out my fire."
I guess pastors get burned on a regular basis.
Yeah, and
a controlled burn.
There's control burns. And then sometimes what's also amazing about the panhandle was that when I went out there, the fire happened March 6th, and then the families were ready to talk, and I began to go out there in April. There was already green sprouts growing up in those burned pastures. There had been a lot of rain. And so by next year, there will be no sign that there had been any fires in the panhandle at all.
I grew up in far west Texas, and wildfires were a danger there, and they would hit the desert. And the kind of cruel irony is sometimes the year after is the most beautiful year you've seen.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak now with Richard in Buckles. Hi, Richard.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Hi.
I really appreciate what y'all have done. I appreciate Skip Hollingsworth's take on this story. I live in Buckles now, my bride and I do, which is east of Temple, but I was in Amarillo for 35 years where I was a writer for the Quarter Horse Journal. And I still freelance for a number of horse magazines. And I've cowboyed on ranches in Texas, New Mexico, and Wyoming. And I appreciate what Skip has done on this particular story and the way he has treated Cody and his girlfriend and the other man, the respect he has shown for him. I also appreciate, in another sense, a lot of times people come out from the cities, from newspapers, from magazines, and they come out west and go to a ranch. And then the story they come out with is, this John Wayne character, he's the last of the cowboys. And we in the cowboy culture kind of laugh at that.
Yeah.
Because, like Skip has said several times, it's just not true. You still have to have a good horse that can handle rugged country to take care of cattle. And just because it's removed from most people's view doesn't mean it's not there.
But here's the thing for me was that going to me, I have worked for Texas Monthly for more than 30 years. I've interviewed rodeo cowboys. I've interviewed ranchers. I've interviewed all the executives at the King Ranch, the biggest ranch in the country that's in South Texas. I've never interviewed a working cowboy in my 30-something years at Texas Monthly. And I have to say, I felt almost this shiver when I realized they exist. You know, it just made me understand in some ways how limited my life in Texas has been.
Do you have, is there, when you're going to do a story like this, do you have boots that you put on? I mean, you want to go as yourself, but you also want to sort of be ready for the terrain that you're going to be looking at and trying to understand.
I bought one pair of cowboy boots in my life during the urban cowboy phase of the 80s, and they were garish yellow ostrich boots. They're ridiculous. I haven't worn them in 20 years.
You still have them, though, don't you?
Of course they're in the closet buried somewhere. No, I just wore sort of, hiking boots, and you don't put on, when you walk into another culture, you don't try to act like you have any idea what's going on. You just treat everyone with respect and you show interest, and people will tell you about their lives. It's always an interesting part of journalism.
All right. I want to go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Ann in Austin. Hi, Ann.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was going to ask a question that, frankly, Skip, you kind of answered in part just now, but I'm curious about your research and writing on this piece, which is just so beautifully told and just so fully capturing the story of these particular people and what happened. And just going into it, what brought you to tell this specific story, and how did the reporting and writing on it unfold for you?
Well, I mean, besides visiting and talking to people face-to-face, we did a lot of texting. Cowboys have cell phones on their ranch, out on their pastures, and I would text a cowboy and say, do you think Cody turned left or right? And then they would text back as they were working cattle. And I texted Cody's mom, and I probably have 200 texts between us. And so modern technology was very helpful in writing a story about a old way of life.
All right, back to the phones now. This time we go to McLean, and we have Christy on the line. Hi, Christy.
Hello. Hi, Skip.
This is Christy Crockett. Unbelievable.
Yes. How are you?
I'm good. This is Cody's mom.
Yes. Well, Brock and I are with his aunt and uncle and cousin, and we got a call from Sydney's Aunt Lauren, and via cell phone, she was holding it up to her car radio so we could listen to your interview.
Because you don't get public radio out in McLean, do you?
I guess not. We just wanted this. I mean, like, I know you're not on Facebook, but this was just a good way to reach a lot of people. And Skip, we just wanted people to know that we appreciate so much the research that you put into this story and the time that you spent with our family and the other people that you interviewed, that you came clean at first. You said, you know, I'm not a cowboy and I'm not going to pretend to know what's going on, but you did it in such a respectful way, and we just appreciate it more than you could know. Like that one caller said, that you didn't portray him as John Wayne, and you didn't portray their love story as tragic, and for that, we're just so thankful.
So you're listening to this show, someone's holding a cell phone up or to their radio?
We did. For 16 minutes, we listened that way, and then Brock's uncle was able to pull it up on his PC.
You know, Christy grew up the daughter of a cowboy. She grew up on the Triangle and Four Sixes Ranch. Her father was a famous foreman. Brock, her husband, was a lifelong cowboy. His dad was a cowboy. And Christy is as tough as they come as a ranch woman. And the night that she learned that Cody was on top of the sand hill burned, a DPS officer said, you don't want to go up there, Christy. And she said, this is my son, and I'm going to go see him.
I think most of us can't imagine what that would be like. What it's like for you to talk to somebody about the greatest loss of their lives.
Well, I think people just want to, you know, there was that book by Sheryl Steinberg, who lost her husband.
Right.
About grief. And she says, no one wants to ask me how I'm feeling. It's too uncomfortable. Ask me. I want to talk about what I've gone through. And I had read an excerpt about that. And I walked into Christy and Brock, and we had a dinner as our first meeting. And I said, what was it like? And they started talking. And just, you know, it's a way to memorialize Cody and Sydney and Sloan.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Brock, Cody's dad, had work to do the next morning, because that's what you do.
That's what you do. He got up the next morning, and he patched fence that had burned, and he tended to the cattle and made sure they were getting fed. And 140 people came to Christy and Brock's home. They have a ranch outside of McLean themselves. Brock covered dish food and just to be with them, and Brock stayed out by the barn because he didn't want to talk about it. That's the way cowboys are. And the hospital sent down what was left of Cody's clothing, which was a Western belt, a pair of boots, and his spurs that he got his senior year in high school. His parents asked him, do you want a senior ring? He goes, no, I want a new pair of spurs. And Brock set them beside his bed, where they remain to this day. and the bloody shirt that Brock put over Cody when he was shivering up on the hill, Brock still has hanging in his closet. And it's his way of saying, this is, you know, holding on to his son's memory.
We mentioned early that Liesl, Sloan's wife, who was able to escape the fire at the ranch with her two children and her mother, she was newly pregnant in March of this year. She's due any minute now, right?
She's due in August. And at one of the dinner that they held for the cowboys and the first responders and the volunteer firefighters, the Franklin family held a dinner. Some people came up to Liesl and said they held it on the ranch to thank them for doing their best that night. Someone came up to Liesl and said, your baby's coming soon. She goes, yeah. Is it a boy or a girl? And Liesl said, it's a boy. What are you going to name him? Well, Liesl said, my first son I've already named Sloan after his dad, Sloan. So I wanted to name him after someone who I thought was a good, wonderful, brave, courageous, someone who's not going to have children of his own, someone who's not going to, but who needs a legacy. I'm going to name my baby Cody.
How's she doing?
Liesl is this strong Christian, like the Crocketts, like everyone out there. They very much believe in God's daily participation in their lives. And she finds in Sloan's life a life well lived, a life of service, a life of devotion. He did well as a young cowman. And she has these, she still, you know, she wears around her neck Sloan's wedding ring, which was one of the things they found out at the hill. And she believes that, you know, Sloan will be this example for others about how to live their young lives.
And there are still teenagers dreaming of this life for themselves.
At the spring branding at the Franklin Ranch, there was a bunch of boys from around the area that came to do the brandings. And they were taught by some of the veteran cowboys. And these are boys that knew Cody, and they worship Cody. I mean, they would walk after around him at the school. You know, it's one of those schools where first through 12th grade are in the same building. Mm-hmm. And they used to, like, you know, follow Cody around because he was this handsome kid, lean as a sapling, good-looking, friendly, changed people's flat tires on the side of the road, did cut their grass. He was the cowboy.
Skip Hollinsworth is executive editor at Texas Monthly. His article, Love and Loss on the Plains, The Day the Fire Came to the Franklin Ranch, is the cover story for the August issue. Skip, it's always wonderful to speak with you.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.